another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast, where we talk all things diversity, inclusion, and all that good stuff. My name is Amanda M. Duca. I'm one of the hosts. I'm sitting next to...
My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
And who do we have, Dino?
I'm glad you asked. This week, we have the wonderful Ama Asante, who was dressed in this gorgeous yellow thing. I couldn't stop talking about it when she was here.
Yeah, it was a nice little jumpsuit. But she directed one of my favorite movies. Like, it's literally in my top 10. It's Belle. Mm-hmm. Was with Gugu
Mbatha-Raw.
Yeah, which was, like I said, it's a story that you never heard before. And I think she has this thing where she knows how to pick up these, like, more like
obscure,
untold
yeah.
stories, like with her new film that premiered at TIFF, Where Hands Touch. That one is with Amandla Sandberg, who everybody knows her from The Hunger Games. But it's a really interesting story about, it's sort of complicated, right?
Like and it's complicated, and it's like, we don't want to talk too much about
it.
But it is a heavy watch, but it's such a good story.
Yeah, it's about a mixed girl living in like
World War II Germany.
And like, you know, we've both, like, we talked about, like, we've all heard the story about Hitler's reign, the Nazi, but I've never heard this type of story before about, like, you know, I never heard, like, how black people
like
were.
biracial German girls or children. There's a whole story on it, and Ama talks about it, and I was just, like, mesmerized that I was like, oh, I'm surprised this story's never been told. And I think that is what Ama does very well, is bringing these stories about you know, people of color or biracial people, and bring them to the forefront that otherwise we would never know unless we Googled it.
Exactly. Yeah. But then, how would we even Google it? Because we don't even know.
Because, like, a lot of people think the Holocaust or World War II, I mean, it doesn't take anything away from those stories.
Exactly.
But it just kind of
adds...
There's more to it. Of course, like, you know, the Jewish people suffered, and then even the LGBTQ people suffered. Mm-hmm. I mean... I'm sure even beyond the biracial children of World War II Germany, there are people that suffered. But just it's a tragic story, but beautifully told.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
So yeah. So without further ado, here is Ama Asante.
So thank you, Ama, so much for being here. You've directed some great films. One of my favorite being Belle. That's probably like one of my all-time favorite films. But you started off acting.
I did, accidentally.
How did that come about? And was directing always the end goal?
No.
Okay.
No, directing definitely wasn't the end goal, because I never saw a director that looked like me, ever. So I started acting. I had a little girlfriend when I was about 10, and I copied everything she did, and she went to tap dancing class every Tuesday, and I wanted to copy her, so I went along to the tap class. And you know, this is the early 80s in London, and they just were not very nice to me. It was a part of the world where there weren't many people of color.
Okay.
And they just weren't very nice, and my mum kind of got wind of it and told my dad, and my dad was like, she's creative, that creativity needs to be nurtured, I'm not having that, you know, silenced in any way. And he looked around London for, I don't know if they have them in the US, but it's called stage school. It's where you learn formal subjects. So you do maths and geography and all the stuff that you normally learn in school, but you do singing and dance and drama at the same time.
Oh, that's fun.
That's really cool. So it's like a performance arts school.
It was a performance arts school, but you could start, I mean, the school started from 5 years old, but I came in at 10, and it goes all the way up to 17. So my dad found that school for me, and I attended, and it was very weird at first because it just wasn't my world, and everybody was really outgoing. It was like if you ever go back and watch The Kids from Fame, it was like that when I first arrived. It was like everybody was like jumping and doing splits in the air.
Oh wait, are you serious?
Everybody was in leotards, and I was like, what is this?
Were you like singing during lunchtime?
We were.
Are you serious?
But it took me 2 years to get there, like, for me, because I was just like, these kids are so precocious. I was 10 years old using language like that, calling other kids precocious. This is so crazy, but... within 2 years, I was completely turned. It was like a cult. I was with those kids. And the school was also an agent as well, an agency. So they put you out for work. So I did my first ad when I was 10. Mm. And then by the time I was 14, I was in a TV series, like our most popular TV series for kind of teen drama.
Yeah, it ran, didn't run for like 30 years.
Yeah, like yeah, 30 yeah. years. Like we grew up.
What was it called? What was it called?
It was called Grange Hill, yeah. Which is the name of the school.
What yes. would it be comparable to in the U.S., do you think?
Well, the thing is, you have to tell me because yeah. it was definitely drama. Mm-hmm. Okay. There was no like comedy in it whatsoever.
Like a soap opera?
Was it soapy?
It was, like a, yeah. it was soapy. And for teens. But it dealt with like some kids were yeah. not allowed to watch it. Oh. So it dealt oh. with like, it dealt with abortion. Yeah. Teen abortion.
Oh, so it's like maybe like a 90210 yeah, or like
oh Degrassi. I'll say yeah, Degrassi. Degrassi.
It dealt yeah. with suicide.
Yeah, that's like
dealt
definitely
with
Degrassi.
Heroin addiction, yeah. like in yeah. a really, you know, in a quite a dark way.
Yeah.
So but it was great for me because I was a terrible actress, but I saw really great performances.
Yeah.
And so that was really good for me because I learned the power of a good story through those other people's performances. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And ultimately that's where I kind of realized I wanted to get to, but I didn't know. I didn't know that's where I was going
yeah.
to.
So you didn't really have like maybe people to look up to or like, yeah. So how do you kind of like navigate those waters when you're just
I was looking up to Cheryl Lee Ralph over here in the States. Like all my role models were over here. Mm-hmm. And I had this kind of really full circle moment because I first arrived in the US when I was 16 because of that TV show. Mm-hmm. And because of one of the heroin storylines, the Reagan White House had invited, you know, the lead kids in the show to come over on one of Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign things. So we come over to visit the White House and be in Washington and then be in New York. And I've never been to New York before. I've only ever seen it on TV. And I'm walking down the street and all these people are coming up to me going, do you know Cheryl Lee Ralph? I didn't know who she was at the time. She's in Dreamgirls.
Yeah, she did Dreamgirls. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She was in Dreamgirls. I'm telling you how old I am. And they were like, because you look like her. And I didn't know what she looked like. And I remember buying every black magazine in America to try and find an image of her. And when I found one, I put her on my wall because that was where I saw myself in some kind of way. And she was in the industry as well. That's how I did it, basically. I then met her like about a year ago. She came to see A United nice. Kingdom.
Oh,
I know. And she asked a question. Nice. And she had like a hat on or something where I couldn't see her properly. So she asked the question and I kind of just answered it. And then when we had the reception afterwards, she came up to me and I nearly passed out.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I know I don't look like you anymore, but when I was a kid, everybody said I look like you. How do you navigate? You don't. I mean, you know, you find yourself where you see yourself. And for me, that was in the U.S., you know?
Oh. I'm curious because you're first generation. Your parents are from Ghana, correct?
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
And we are too. And I'm curious because we, you know,
both first generation?
Yeah, we're both first generation. Yeah. My parents are Nigerian.
My parents are from the Philippines.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, there's all these expectations that come with being, you know, a first generation from any country in like America. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you come here, you have to be like a doctor or a lawyer.
Of course. So it was the same in
so
like
is it the
UK?
Same?
Yeah. It's the same in the UK, but I had this really weird experience.
Okay.
In which my dad was not like that. Oh. So he was with my brother. You must be a scientist.
Yeah.
And my brother was and is. But he didn't do that with us. And I'm not sure also if it was just, I mean, I remember him sitting us down at different times and saying, what do you want to do? And then pushing us really hard in that. So I think my brother probably did want to be a scientist somewhere. But definitely I know with my friends, that whole thing, be a lawyer. But I mean, there's like
doctor,
three things.
Yeah,
there.
Like
there's
doctor, lawyer, scientist, engineer.
Yeah, right? Yeah. There's like those four things, right? Yeah. So whereas my dad, and I base the character in Belle of Lord Mansfield on my dad, because my dad was someone who had one foot like really firmly in tradition, which I think you guys will get if you're first generation is, but then the other foot was like stepping over right into progression, and it caused a conflict in him quite often. So he was two people in one that created this one person, and you know, I got the benefit of the progressive side of him in that way, where he was just like, this is what you want to do, and I support you, and you may be poor and not have a roof over your head, but I'll find a way. You know, there was some way that I don't know. He had faith.
Yeah.
Is your brother older or younger?
He's much older. He's a decade. Kofi, you're much older. You are an entire decade older than me.
Well, I think maybe it is like firstborn.
Yeah, maybe it is.
They have more pressure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
But I've seen families where it's gone all the way through.
Yeah. Oh,
like
no, my family was
four engineers in a family.
My mom, yeah, everybody, my mom's either engineer or doctor, yeah, or something. My mom's a lawyer. So it's like, it definitely trickled down to us. Like, you guys have to do this.
Yeah, right. I mean, with me, right, it was like, they were like all, okay, you're going to be a writer, whatever, no. And then I just kept on pushing.
You're like,
and then finally, they were just exhausted. Yeah, like, whatever.
Do what you want to do. Like, you just wore them out.
Yeah. My dad still calls me. Approach. He's like, you know, you can still go to med school. It's not too late.
No.
And I'm like, I'm not going to med school.
That's so funny.
He's like, it's not too late.
But I think once they see your success,
yeah, that's when it's
changes. Then they'll start bragging, and then like they start posting.
I get that with my uncles, whose children are all scientists.
Yeah.
I get that with, if you see what Emma's doing,
Amazon.
Finally, they kind of get that you can survive doing it.
Yeah.
But listen, when you're first generation, usually they haven't seen anyone do it before.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
They only know what they know.
Exactly.
So
we can't really fault them.
You can't fault them because what they're saying is, we need to know that you have a solid way of life.
Yeah, exactly. That you're not going to
end
forward,
up.
Moving
forward, right? Yeah. Because, and growing up in technically someone else's country, which is what it is for them, it's probably scary. Like, they make these choices, right? But they know their kids have to live with them.
Exactly.
You didn't make the choice. They did.
Exactly.
And so there is that, I think there's that will, there's that wish to ensure, insulate you from a choice that could go all the way left, you know?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So, you direct Belle, United Kingdom, and now we're Hands Touch, and you tell these, like, very kind of rich stories about people of color at the center, and they're about oppression, segregation, interracial relationships, and they're all in different time periods, which I have never seen before.
Like stories that you know, you've never really heard of.
Yeah.
And what kind of motivated you to do stories like these?
To be honest with you, so my first movie that didn't get released in the US was, I don't know if you're familiar with Ken Loach's movies or Mike Lee's, you know, a really gritty, urban, you know, contemporary social commentary drama. And that was my first movie. That's the one that actually I won all the awards for, and I won a British Academy Award for, but it never got released in the UK. And the only movie like the one you've described, all the three that you've described, that I actually wanted to make and intended to make, was Where Hands Touch, the one I've just made. So it was supposed to be my second movie.
Yeah, right. It was like a 12-year journey.
Right. So I was told it was too big for me. And just to cut a really long kind of journey short, what I realized I had to do was prove that this movie wasn't too big for me. So when certain movies were coming to me, like Belle, the picture postcard was, it was actually the BFI that asked my producer, Damien Jones, to send me that postcard. When I was like, for me, it was a game plan. It was, let me make this movie because it's period. It's got a woman of color at the center. It came to me because of the script I had written for Where Hands Touch, where they were like, oh, she can write a biracial girl in 1940s Germany. You know, surely she can do one in 18th century England. So that came to me because of that. And I was kind of like, at first I was skeptical that they wouldn't let me make the kind of film I wanted to. But then I kind of thought, just go with it, because if you do, then it will be very difficult for the powers that be to say that you can't make you can't make Where Hands Touch. And so I did that. And the truth is, if I had made Where Hands Touch as my second film as intended, there would be no Belle. There might be a story of this character, but it certainly wouldn't be the story you saw on screen, I can assure you.
Yeah.
I got 3/4 of the money raised for Where Hands Touch by making Belle, right? So I got that finance, but it wasn't enough. And they was still, for the next quarter, the resistance I was getting was, this is still too big for you. So I'd shown I could do polished, and I could do very British, and I could do period. That's what I wanted to show with Belle. But they were still saying it was too big. So when David Oyelowo comes to me, and David is my friend from days gone by, and he comes out of drama school, and I give him his first job out of drama school on TV from a TV series I'd written and produced. So 18 years later, he comes to me with A United Kingdom, says this is his passion project, will you do it? I jump on board that because I go, I can make this so epic. And if I do, they cannot ever say again that Where Hands Touch is too big. And of course, all these films have they're tied together by the fact that I make them, so I make them in a certain way, but they have elements in them that prove why I could make where hands touch. Mm-hmm. So that's what you see, I think, in the connection, mm-hmm. is you see that connection because I'm using them as stepping stones. Mm-hmm. I'm quite honest about that to show why I could make where hands touch.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so, that's well, a what interesting
what were
journey,
they saying? Yeah. Why was it too, what was it, like, what does that mean? It's too big.
I think it's something that a lot of women hear.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
You know, it's as if we're kind of, you know, riding some wild horse that we're not really going to be able to control, mm-hmm. in some ways. I don't really know what it means other than you're not capable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's just me.
That's what it sounded like.
It sounds like they said it. They're like basically saying
it's like a nice way. Yeah, it's like a nice way. Yeah.
This is not your space. This is not your arena. I mean, you got to think about where hands touch. It's like, from behind the camera, I'm taking up space where, you know, a woman of color, we haven't really existed. Mm-hmm. And then I'm placing a girl of color at the center. And that's also space, mm-hmm. where we haven't really existed. So it's like a double whammy. Mm-hmm.
And in a period.
Like, and there's not, and it's a World War II
exactly,
Holocaust.
There's World War II. We don't own that. That belongs to a very certain type of director.
Yeah, but that narrative is something I've never heard before.
Me too. Even Bell's the story, but I'd never heard it before.
Right.
Yeah.
So and that's why, like, I just think, you know, whether you believe in, like, you know, whoever is up there, mm-hmm. As Sandy said yesterday, you know, at the Emmys, whoever she is, whatever you believe in, you know, sometimes you're guided in a direction and you didn't intend to go in that direction. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I've heard stuff, oh, I'm as obsessed with interracial relationships and biracial people. No, I was obsessed with one, which was Where Hands Touch. Mm-hmm. I really mm-hmm. wanted to tell that story. And the other two certainly came to me, and I decided to use them as stepping stones. Now, there are other movies that I have in development. They're mm-hmm. just, you know, they weren't the ones that the powers that be wanted to finance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you make the movies that you can, you make them to the best of your ability, and you use them as a way to move forward. Because, you know, the big thing for women is getting to a third film, a fourth film,
exactly.
fifth film, yeah, exactly. is almost impossible. Mm-hmm. So with every movie you're making, you're also working out, how does this lay the landscape for me being able to make the next movie. That's what you're constantly having to negotiate.
Yeah, so, like, Where Hands Touch, I mean, for me, watching any World War II movie is so hard.
Yeah.
This
one didn't make it any easier for you.
Let me tell you.
You add this relationship, and you had a woman of color in it. It's just like, it hit you. I had to pause it a couple of times to kind of, like,
And you watched it on a link. Like, I'm saying to everybody, don't watch it on a link or press. Go and see it in the cinema. Yeah.
I will go see it.
But it's killing people when they see it in the cinema, like in a good way. I mean, but sometimes the places, you know, because I had to pause it for myself when I was writing it, in the sense, you know, I'd be bawling while I was writing this. But there are some really kind of unexpected moments that always catch me.
Yeah.
Like, her little brother.
Oh God! Like, and just
no spoilers.
Yeah.
No spoilers.
There are sweet moments, I would say.
But even there are ugly moments too, mm-hmm. with him and her relationship that kind of break my heart and still make me cry, even mm-hmm. though I wrote them.
Yeah.
You know, and so moments with her mother where you just go, oh my God, what would you do if you were the mother of this child, mm-hmm. who is just doing everything that teenagers do, but there's a war happening and we're in one of the most horrific times possible. But
I mean, like, I mean, it's not necessarily based on one true story.
It's composite.
There's multiple stories. So like, upon doing your research for this, were there things that, like, you were utterly shocked at, or that
everything.
And, like, how did you even stumble upon this?
Everything shocked me. Getting my head around it was really, really tough, because what struck me is how much we are products of our time and our place. And we see, all of us see through a gaze that is informed by our time and our place, our context, right? Mm-hmm. So when we see somebody else responding in a different way, we go, that's really weird or odd, or there's something wrong with them. We don't accept that we probably would operate in a very similar way if we were in their position. And so that has been the journey of the film for me over mm-hmm. the 12 years, is to accept and recognize that. I discover these children because I'm making my first film, and I discover that where I'm shooting it, or I know that where I'm shooting it has some of the oldest black communities in Europe. Mm. And I realize at that point that why is it that I don't know about them enough about them? And why is it that I know so much more about African American history mm-hmm. than I know about those who I'm you know, my background is closest to, which mm-hmm. is those who are born and raised in Europe, but of an African diaspora, of mm-hmm. the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about that. And so I start to Google, and I want to know more about the histories, because like in the UK, we got this thing. It feels like our history began in like 1947 mm-hmm. when mm-hmm. one boat came over. And, you know, now we know about Bell, and we know that we were roaming around long before that. And certainly there were people of color in Germany before World War I, mm-hmm. for sure. Although this is set in World War II. But I start Googling and I keep coming up with this term, Rhineland bastards, yeah. Rhineland bastards. It's so derogatory, and it's like, even where is the Rhineland? I didn't even know where it was. Mm-hmm. So alongside that comes a picture of a little girl, and she's got a little fro, and she's Afro-German, and she's surrounded by, you know, so-called Aryan white girls, as Hitler would call them. Mm-hmm. And she's got this unreadable expression on her face. And I pretty much can guarantee that as first generationers, you would feel the same way. You go, where is she from? Yeah. How did she get
yeah.
there?
Yeah, yeah.
Who exactly. is she? Mm-hmm. And what happened to her? Mm-hmm. And as I start, you know, investigating more and more and more, I'm discovering more about how these children came to be. And essentially, it's the First World War, the French colonies in Africa. France brings over its soldiers, its black soldiers, African soldiers from its colonies to fight in World War One. Mm-hmm. When Germany loses, France puts in soldiers who are part of the occupation of Germany, and some of those are these African soldiers, and they mix with the local community, and after World War One, a generation mm-hmm. of biracial children are born. Yeah. And they're known as these Rhineland bastards, or Hitler's problem. Mm-hmm. And they have no power. They have no, they're not wealthy, they're not doctors, they're not teachers, mm-hmm. they're not influencers of any kind, but they can procreate. Mm-hmm. And so that's when he decides, okay, the way to deal with them is to just have them sterilized, then they die out in one generation. Oh, wow. We do it with no anesthetic, mm-hmm. and the problem is dealt with. And then we don't have to deal with their mothers, who could be involved in any way with the rest of German society. Do they have brothers who are part of the SS? Do they have fathers who are part of the Gestapo? Mm-hmm. Hitler isn't seen to be attacking them. And so, because he just does it quietly. And so my thing was, when I discover these children, I'm like, well, we know what was happening to Jewish people at mm-hmm. the time. If we know what was happening to them, and I'm thinking, well, in America, we could be strange fruit, you know, in America still, in that period.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, and thinking about how we existed around the world at that particular point, mm-hmm. Wherever there was oppression and where we were, if there's such a thing as the food chain, we were at the bottom of it, right? So I think, God, what must have happened to these children? And then as I start to explore, it's different. Yeah. They did not experience the machine of murder in the same way. It was on a case-by-case basis. Mm. If you met the wrong SS officer on the wrong day, you could be thrown into a camp. I certainly heard of stories of completely black people, you know, African men who existed throughout the war and were not taken into camps, in Berlin, mm-hmm. for instance. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you were Jewish, that could never happen. You yeah. could never outwardly exist.
Yeah.
So how is it that these kids existed, you know, in a way where their lives might be preserved, where it's because they were not any real threat to Hitler. God. So that complexity, what does that mean then? It means that they exist in an environment where they still go to school with German so-called Aryans.
Yeah.
They're but all the teachers who would teach anything different are gone. Only Nazi teachers exist. All books have been burned and disappear that might teach you anything else. The nation has claimed all children. Mm. So it says parents do not raise their children, the nation does. Children are encouraged in Hitler Youth, which is mandatory, mm-hmm. to speak up against their parents if their parents tell them any different, and Lord knows what might happen to them. Mm-hmm. So then, therefore, these kids are existing in this environment where National Socialism is the word of the day. They have this disbelonging, but actually their only community mm-hmm. is this world, because they don't know each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, only if you have a sibling And then your siblings might be white. Yeah. You might be Aryan. So everything confounded me. Everything.
So heavy.
It is so heavy.
It is heavy.
And it's shown in the film. Yeah. I'm just like, I mean, I'm not spoiling anything when I say like that. They're when they're in the classroom and they all turn around and they say Heil Hitler to that, to like the officer coming
comes in. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, what? You know?
Yeah.
And they're all little kids.
Yeah. Like, yeah. There's an amazing photo that exists out there. If you Google, you'll find it. And it's of a little boy. And he's biracial. And he's wearing a little, I don't know what you guys call a sweater without sleeves. We call them tank tops.
Like a vest, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a sweater without sleeves. Yeah. And on it, he's got a swastika sewn. And he's got all these Hitler youth boys standing around him. And he, you know, that's his world.
Oh,
that complexity crazy. That is something that most of us find very difficult to get our heads around.
Yeah.
But then I, you know, got on a plane and went to interview black survivors of the Holocaust, Afro-Germans of the Holocaust, and had these conversations with them. And it was, you know, they were not a monolith. Mm-hmm. So it's not like everybody was the same, but it was interesting to hear the patterns in their stories.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you never really hear about the story of the black people during Hitler's reign. Like you obviously hear about what happened to the Germans and to the LGBTQ people, but you just never really hear. Yeah, that's you so do. Interesting.
I think Chinua Achebe, the writer, has this saying that until the lion has his own storyteller, the hunter will always be the hero, right? And I would less eloquently say, you know, we don't get written about also because oftentimes we're the powerless in the situation, right? So history gets written about the people who have most power.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, that's usually men.
The men,
and they're usually white.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they're straight.
Right. And they're straight. They say they are. Right. So, okay, that's a whole nother.
That's a whole other conversation.
Right. Okay. So take Bell, for instance. Like, the easiest thing to do would have been to write that story from Lord Mansfield's point of view. You can make 7 films about Lord Mansfield because there's so much written about him. You know, the evidence of Dido Elizabeth Bell was much smaller, had to be pieced together. The history that was written about her, she was always a byproduct of some other story, right? So you go, there's more about Lord Mansfield, then there's more about Elizabeth, her cousin, is the next one right? And then you finally get to Bell, and she really is like at the bottom of the pile. Mm-hmm. So that's the reality. You're not really... And then what happens when you don't know our stories? And it's not just stories of women of color, it's just stories generally of people of color, where we've been there and we've been significant at particular times in history, but we're totally erased from those stories. Is that even we as people of color respond, we reject the history when we see it because we go, that doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
And I'm really obsessed with the other within, you know, those who look like us, they talk like us, but they, how comes you don't behave like us? And in history, we have really maligned those people and persecuted them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so today, you know, when you think about someone like Lena, you go, you recoil. Mm-hmm, but we've been trained to do that because we haven't been allowed to know our history.
Yeah.
We've only been allowed to know another kind of history, and so we don't even know what the human condition would allow us to do and how it would allow us to respond, because we've been kept from those stories and we don't even realize it.
We talk
about colonization of the mind, but
it's crazy.
It's big.
It is something that you, I mean, obviously we weren't taught this, so you hear it and it's like, that didn't happen, like that doesn't sound right.
Can't work, right?
We're not given the books and, you know, taking the exams on this type of things, like we know, like
said. So if you don't know another if you don't know another Afro-German, right?
Exactly.
And you exist in this world, right? Who you going to have a relationship with?
Exactly.
Who you going to get married to?
Yeah.
Who you going to have kids with? Like, you going to stay at home and rot?
Yeah.
You know, what is survival? What does survival mean? Right?
Yeah.
So it becomes very, very complex and very big, but also very frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
Very frightening.
And then along those lines, like, obviously right now in Hollywood, we're having like a moment, you know, where people that were traditionally marginalized or really taking a stand and really, like, you know,
speaking
out and wanting their voices to be heard and their stories to be told. And, you know, we keep talking about this, and it's like, you know, diversity, inclusion, and everything, you know, it's still it's not, like, you know, great.
It's not fixed. Like, they said on the Emmys.
It's not fixed. Like, they said on the Emmys. But I mean, there is at least I think there is progress. All right. And I think there that is. People's voices yeah. are, I think are so. Being heard. Yeah.
Well, I'm talking to you. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
and I'm talking to both of you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not just a one-way thing. It's a two-way thing. So something's happening, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So for you, though, like, being a figure of this moment, and you're an established director, you're a woman of color, you're doing great things with your platform. What does it mean for you to be part of this kind of this movement?
Do you know, I think when you're in it, it's really, really hard. I remember going to see The Butler, mm-hmm. And it was a BAFTA Q&A in London, and Oprah was part of the Q&A alongside the director, and Forest Whitaker was there, and I took my sister along, and, like, you know, the moment I saw Oprah, I just had a big fat migraine, because it's like, oh my God, I could touch her, she's right there. And I remember... it was a very small screening room, and I remember about halfway through, Belle wasn't out yet, I started to cry, mm-hmm. and I just couldn't stop weeping, and my sister said to me, why are you weeping? And I said, because there is, in this particular season, like this particular period, there are all these movies that are coming out now with people of color at the center, and they're weaving this tapestry. And it dawned on me that Belle was going to be part of that tapestry, mm-hmm. although I didn't know that it would be received or mm-hmm. embraced, mm-hmm. But I just knew my film was going to be part of that. And that made me weep. But of course, I wept also because I didn't know if it was just going to be a moment. Like, is this like another fad, another phase? I've been around long enough to see them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like, you know, Black is the New Black. And then we're not anymore. Exactly. And then, you know, we kind of move on to something else. And, you know, those moments where Africa is a muse and things get shot in Africa and then it's not anymore because now it's the Middle East or somewhere else becomes the muse for whatever the background is going to be in a movie or a TV show. So I didn't know about that. And I think that when you're in it, to be honest with you, I tweeted the other day that I wear my hiking boots to work because it does feel uphill all the time to me. And I don't feel established. Mm-hmm. And I realize that there's privilege in the fact that I've made four movies moving on to my fifth movie. Mm-hmm. But I cannot help, and I do compare myself to my white male peers in the UK. And I know where I could be. Where I might be, you know? And so for me, the struggle is real still. Yeah. And I, you know, being an exception that proves the rule also, and, you know, being a Brit, because when you add Brit to my, all my intersections, it's a little bit scary because you never know when it's going to stop.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like I feel established, like, okay, I'm just going to lay back and come on, you know, in my smoking jacket and smoke a cigar and say, bring me the next movie. Yeah, it's still a struggle.
I mean, I guess, like, the hope is just, you know, the work that you do or we do collectively just kind of makes it easier for the next generation of filmmakers.
It is a collective thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm selfish in the sense that I've been around long enough to see really talented people from my country in the UK. I mean, super talented, who just gave up, or who, just to get dark for a second, committed suicide, or who just didn't make it through. And I think that we can't and we mustn't expect artists to purely be there to open the doors for the next generation. I do believe it's climb and carry. But it isn't just stand on my shoulders, because I'm an artist too, and my existence is motivated by my wish to create every day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said, we've just come back from TIFF where Hands Touch had its world premiere, and I said, you know, I'm not a campaigner. Some artists are. Mm-hmm. I'm not an activist. But anything I do in this area is done because it's necessary, because I need to move things out of the way so that I can get to just be an artist. Like, I live for the day where I don't have to campaign to do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's really important, and I think that we free artists up as well, particularly this generation that you're talking about, this moment, this movement, to say your job is not only to be the stepping stone that others use, but your job is also to give us who you are through the art you create. Yeah. We're losing artists. We're losing cultural moments in themselves, because artists are not being artists, mm-hmm. they're being shoulders for others to climb on. And I think it's got to be lift and carry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point.
Well, climb and carry. Yeah. Climb and carry.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned you're doing a fifth film. Is that something that you could talk about now?
Yeah, it's been announced. Okay. It's a book called The Billion Dollar Spy. Mm-hmm. It's been, based on the book by David E. Hoffman, Pulitzer Prize winning author. Mm-hmm. It's a story, it's set in the Cold War in Russia in 1977, so I am slowly making my way back to modern day.
you're getting there.
And what I love about it, on the face of it, it seems very different to all of my other films. It's a story of a CIA agent and his relationship with a Russian spy who's a man. The agent is about 28 and the spy is in his 50s. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a true story of a spy who gave the Carter government, the American government, so much Russian intel that it was in excess of $1 billion in worth. Mm. And I love it because it's a brohood movie, but I also love it because it's kind of the inside out version of what drove me to want to tell a United Kingdom. Mm. You know, United Kingdom is what happens when outsiders are running your country and you don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. Certainly that's the element that drew me to it. You know, what do you do? What are your elements of power to do something about it? And this story is about what happens when insiders are running your country and you don't agree with what they're doing. You don't like the way that they're running your country. What do you do then? And so the story unfolds. And so I think that this is a lot of white men on screen.
Good. Yeah.
But I think it's very, very... I am interested in being as free as Spielberg is.
Yeah.
Mm. Right. So, you know, when he comes to The Color Purple, and I think he does a really great job as one of my favorite movies still, and I still say all the time that there wouldn't be Belle without The Color Purple because he showed the industry that a black female experience can connect a movie, to a universal audience and can carry a movie. So, but I want to be like him. He can do Amistad and he can do, you know, and I want to be able to do all kinds of people as long as their human condition somehow connects to mine, then I think I should be able to explore those stories. So I'm not leaving for long. Yeah. I'll be back. but I am interested in because it's just a beautifully written script by Ben August.
Yeah.
And I love Warden Media. I love Weed Road Pictures, who are... you know, producing this, and it's just, it's just a cool script and a cool story.
Now we like to kind of close off this chat with a couple of fun questions.
Yeah. It's called the facts, FAQs. It's pronounced facts.
He's so excited about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I saw that you were tweeting a lot about the Emmys. I'm assuming you
I
were.
I was.
Yeah.
You saw that?
Yeah.
I did. At home, in my bed with my burger and my Coca-Cola.
So with that said, what are you currently binging on TV or streaming or anything?
So I have been binging on, I had to stop. I finished all of it, but I had to stop because of the release of my movie. But I have been binging, of course, on Handmaid's Tale.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I keep telling him to get on
Handmaid's
Tale.
I mean, like,
how have you not got on it?
I don't know
it,
why.
Dude.
Okay, here's my, I know in the industry, I am just so scared of it, honestly. I'm really scared.
You
kind of
should be.
Yeah, you really should.
I started it and I was
like,
I can't.
Parallels that are going on.
And it's like, oh, and I heard there's like no levity at all. And I'm all, I can't.
No, but you know what? It's such high quality
drama. And I think what we talked to Joseph Fiennes, name drop, on the red carpet.
Go for it.
But, and he said something really good about it. He was like, oh, there's a female protagonist who's resisting, and out of that resistance comes inspiration.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah. You definitely see it, and you definitely, I mean, where the hope comes from is that you are rooting for her, rooting for her and the other women, this entire world. And again, you know, I talk about how we're all conditioned. So our conditioning says this cannot exist forever.
Yeah.
Like this cannot exist forever. And of course, you know, when you finish, you go,
yeah,
exactly.
You know, it's, you know, so I think it's great. I think it's, It's beautiful production design. It's beautiful costume design. It's beautiful writing. It's beautiful directing. It's beautiful cinematography. Yeah. Like, if you love storytelling, this is.
I'm just a scaredy cat. I mean, I could watch a slasher film, a thrill. Like,
watch it over a binge on a weekend. Yeah. Stop at 6 o'clock in the evening.
And then watch something more Saved by the Bell or something.
It's definitely worth it. Yeah. You shouldn't miss it. And you shouldn't wait for like I did with Game of Thrones or something, and wait 5 years behind everybody else. Like, you shouldn't wait. Do it while in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm just very like,
it's a great,
especially watching stuff like that, and you think about the women in your life, and you're just like, you're just like,
It's depressing, but it's so good. And this last season, it's like, you can see there's a turning point that's about to happen.
Well, good.
I don't know. I don't want to spoil it.
Let's not spoil it. Can I just say Nick? Anyway.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to remember that name. Okay. So we are living in this time of, you know, reboots, revivals, remakes, and everything. Uh-huh. So if you were able to remake a classic romantic comedy.
Oh my God.
With people of color.
I would.
What would you make?
I was going to say something that I'd get in trouble. I won't say it. I would do Notting Hill.
Do you have a cast in mind already?
Well, I could work one out pretty quickly because Notting Hill is full of black people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't you know?
Yeah.
You wouldn't. but it is. And, you know, some pretty early communities in Notting Hill of people of color. So I think I would do my Notting Hill,
that's so
romantic
sweet.
Comedy. Can we put Idris in it?
And me and Amanda audibly gasped at the same time.
Idris Elba, yes.
And I don't know that there are too many amazing, wonderful.
Maybe Gugu.
Black actress. Maybe Gugu, but wait. There's Thandi or there's Naomi. No, hang on. Have I got her name
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. I know you're talking about a Bond that she was in.
No,
she was,
no. Have I got Harris? Her name right? No, No.
Oh, yeah. Moonlight.
No, not from Moonlight. This is, oh my God, she's brown skin, dark skin, beautiful girl. I feel bad. I'm not going to say her name. Anyway, no, this is not Naomi or Thandi. This is.
What was she in?
I'm sure is she like Aya King, A-Y-A?
Aja Naomi King from How to Get Away with Murder.
Thank you. Am I saying her name wrong?
Aja. I think it's AJA.
AJA.
Aja Naomi King.
Yeah.
So we all pieced it. We did it together.
I like her better.
Yeah, I was going to say, sorry, Naomi. I'm really sorry to do that to your name because we follow each other as well.
That is so sweet.
That is really disgusting. They're great actors. But can I, you know, she would be my lead.
She would be.
Can we make this happen?
Right? A remake? Naja. Working That's title. Is it working title that made that? I'm here.
Right.
Well, we'll do it.
We're gonna speak that into the universe.
Yeah, let's speak into the universe. Right? That would be great. I think you should. Yeah, that's.
But there's Damson. There's the other Idris. Damson Idris.
Oh,
as well,
yeah, he's
right?
good. You know, yeah, right? He was in a movie at TIFF too.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I'm stealing all all these movies now. But I could do Love Actually as well.
Love Actually.
Go. Oh my God, with a whole people.
With a whole black cast, an entire black cast. Yeah. Wouldn't that be incredible?
Oh my God.
I was actually thinking
Again,
Love Actually.
Let's make this happen, guys.
Yeah.
Let's make this happen.
So obviously.
But wait, one more.
Okay. we got you going.
Pretty Woman.
Who would be the Julia Roberts character?
Oh my gosh, Pretty Woman would be a great one.
Wait.
I think
that
would be a good Idris Aja come because Idris is a bit older than her.
So that could be a good.
I'm seeing that.
That could be a good combination.
I'm seeing that.
Because you see him being like
the wealthy, older
Bond's like, you know, businessman.
With the glasses, because he pulled off those glasses in.
Idris, honey, can you hear this?
He pulled off those glasses in Molly's Game.
I'm creating our next project, Idris.
Oh, and in Esther Rebel, yes.
Of course.
Okay, so obviously you're known for your period pieces. So if you could live in any period that racism and oppression didn't exist.
I mean, what are you trying to say?
No, racism didn't exist.
It would be the future.
No, so if racism didn't exist, like let's say
if all that stuff never happened,
take racism out of the equation.
What period would you?
You
would
know,
you
I'd
like
be
to
walking
live?
Around as Belle. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, I thought I was gonna do a day like, kind of like trussed up in one of those gowns, one of those corsets, and then I saw Sarah Gadon and Gugu Mbatha-Raw being, you know. taken cinched? Out of one.
Oh. Yeah.
And it, I just saw the lines on their back. Yeah. And I was like, is that, are we allowed to do that to them? Is that like, yeah, is that yeah, like yeah. some health and safety? And I was like, I'm not doing that, it. I'm yeah. staying in my Adidas tracksuit.
Right. I was thinking I would love to live when like the Hollywood, the golden age of Hollywood period.
Golden
I think
age,
that would be pretty
or
cool.
even like the Harlem, like that whole.
Yeah.
The Harlem Renaissance.
Renaissance yeah. period could be quite cool, but yeah. with no racism.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No racism. Racism's out of the equation.
Let's qualify no racism.
I would love that.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
So our final question is, we ask this to all our guests. Is there an underrepresented voice, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, and storyteller in the industry that isn't getting enough representation that like you want to give a shout out
an
to?
An individual?
Yeah. I mean, there's I know there's plenty.
But just
but
like
if you,
somebody who's not in the mainstream that maybe we haven't heard of that needs
give,
to be. Yeah.
Give a shout out, put in the spotlight.
Yeah, so she's British. Mm-hmm. And she is a writer and she's a director and she currently works for a production company called Balloon in the UK. Mm-hmm. She also is a blogger and she writes incredible blogs, but she's mainly she's a great screenwriter. Mm-hmm. And her name is Danielle Scott Horton.
Okay.
She is known as Danielle Dash on Twitter, okay. at Danielle Dash.
Okay.
I'm giving we'll a huge
her.
Shout
I'm gonna
out
follow her.
to the black British female talent who is Danielle Scott Horton.
Okay.
That's good. Great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here and for talking to us.
Oh my God, you gave us so much to think about.
Exactly.
We're looking forward to Notting Hill with Idris Elba.
Or no, Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman. Yes. Oh, so we're going to make all three of us.
Yeah.
Love
we
Actually.
Do them
Pretty
all.
Yes, I would love seeing a Love Actually.
And me and Amanda
Actually.
Could be in the background.
Yeah, we'll
something.
Be like baristas or something.
We could be baristas. Cool. Well, thank you
thank
so
much.
Thank
you so much. This was great.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Great.